You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
So joining us as a special treat this week, we have Alex Giannopoulos and Dennis Mascari, who have recently started a podcast series called Fail Scouts. You can find out how you can subscribe and see their show notes at failscouts.com. They are both assistant location scouts and work in a location department for Better Call Saul and also Breaking Good, as well as a lot of other New Mexican film and television productions. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, we're real happy to be here.
We first met Alex in Albuquerque at the Albuquerque Breaking Bad Fan Fest and had a lot of fun talking with him, both on an official capacity and behind the scenes. Thought he's a really cool dude, and we were excited to find out you had started doing a podcast, guys, because I know you had a podcast that you did way back when. Could you tell the people a little bit about what Fail Scouts is all about and what they can expect to hear on your show?
Oh, certainly. So our new podcast is called Fail Scouts, and basically it's a term we came up with. The title of our podcast is a term we came up with for when you're kind of set out to fail in our job, because sometimes, you know, you're set out to, all right, well, let me start over. Basically, I'm going a little ahead of myself.
Is this how the podcast goes every week?
This is the fail cast. We're setting up to fail.
Yep.
Exactly. We're good at failing. No, basically, it's a show about where we kind of lay out what we do in our jobs, which is location managing and location scouts. So our job is to find locations for TV shows like Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. And then we also set up the logistics to shooting on location, which is kind of a big job. And, you know, there's a lot of factors involved that people take for granted and a little bit. And we just kind of like to get our own story out there and our own behind the scenes from the very bottom of the food chain and the filmmaking world. And the title of our show, Fail Scouts, is just a term we came up with for when we're scouting for something and we already showed them the perfect thing and they want us to keep finding more things for them to reject, which is called a fail scout.
So you guys are both from Albuquerque, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're locals.
And one thing I didn't suspect, but seems obvious in retrospect, is that location scouting seems to be a very regional or localized thing. Like there's not like a pool of scouts in Hollywood that you dispatch to like someplace in Minnesota for filming Fargo or someplace in Washington, D.C. to do House of Cards, because those people wouldn't know where all the good spots are. Is that fairly widespread throughout the globe or nation?
Yes and no. Basically, there's a location manager and he's the one in charge of the department. And a lot of times location managers come from L.A. or elsewhere, you know, and they show up in the town. But yes,
if it tends to be a big project, like the big L.A. managers they'll manage the project wherever it is. But a lot of they'll hire a lot of locals.
Yeah. But when they come in, they ask who knows the area and things like that. But sometimes you are kind of sent out to, like, a lot of times Dennis has done shows in smaller towns in New Mexico that we've never even been to. You know, and you kind of just have to go in and drive around and find things on your own sometimes, even if you don't know the town.
Yeah.
But yes.
That makes it more exciting, though. The less you know, it's like the discovery is a little greater.
Yeah. But but being a local does help, you know, especially when it comes to things like where we can and cannot be, things like that.
Do you find with location scouting that you mentioned driving a lot? Like percentage wise, what would you say? How much of your job do you spend driving around? Like, how much of it do you like kind of pre-scout out with Google Maps? I mean, is there any other kind of like high tech methods you use to kind of narrow down your search, or is it just driving around?
Well, I think it varies on what you're looking for. Sometimes you'll use the maps to find topographical geographic locations if you're looking for some, you know, exteriors. And other times you're just driving around because you know the area and you know where to find these certain things that they're talking about.
Well, I'd say you drive 50-50. Basically, yeah. Half of our job is going out and looking for things. Half of our job is setting up logistics and office work and making phone calls and things like that. So, it depends what you're looking for. If you're looking for something really specific, like, you know, a blue house with polka dots or something, you know, you have to go out and look, you know. If you're looking for something like a big field, you know, then, you know, Google Maps can be very handy, you know, to see it from above, before, you know, because sometimes driving around, you can't see something like over a berm or a wall or something that you can see in Google
Maps. In the last year, like I had 36,000 miles I drove and 33,000 were work miles.
So. Yeah. Well, wow.
Yeah, we drive a lot. It's part of it for sure. And then when you do find something on Google, you have to physically go out there and look at it and get pictures. And even if you've been somewhere before, you have to physically go out there and get new pictures because the season may have changed since your old pictures or something like that as well. So, yeah, we drive all the time.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about the seasons, because I remember Dennis was telling a story about some director wanting him to find the Garden of Eden in New Mexico in March. And you're like, there is no such thing. There is not a speck of green around.
You take him to the soundstage and you say, here it is.
Exactly. Bring in some shrubs.
They didn't have a soundstage. That was another problem with that show.
Oh, boy.
Oh, wow.
That was another thing. They wanted a big empty warehouse in Santa Fe, which did not exist. We ended up finding them at a closed grocery store.
I think a lot of people, when they hear about, you know, location scouting, they're like, you're just looking for really cool buildings and, you know, just like iconic properties. But it seems like that, you know, driving past something like, ooh, this is the perfect spot, that's like just the beginning of the process. There is a lot more that, you know, with securing the rights and the technical aspects. Would you guys talk about some of the challenges there?
Sure. We do everything legitimately. I mean, there are some in movie history, people used to kind of just go around and shoot things and steal shots and worry about it later. But these days we have to do the due diligence. We have to find the owners. We have to contact them. We have to, you know, make sure.
Lawyers have become a big part of filmmaking.
Yeah, we got to go through legal departments and things like that. And yeah, we really have to dig in, find the people, give them a pitch, you know, tell them what we were looking for, give them an offer, make a deal on every single place we do. And then there's also like the neighbors, the parking. Everywhere we go, we have to secure a parking lot for base camp and for catering and things like that.
It's a lot of legwork.
So for every location you see on a show, whether it's like 1 minute on screen, you know, you have to imagine that we have to bring a whole film crew to that house. We have to put them in a place to park. We got to feed them that day, all on location. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge amount of logistics involved with it.
Sometimes too, you're moving the people across the city. Like you're taking 100 people from one end of town to the other end of town, and you know, you have to provide them with directions how to get there, put signs up on the road.
We make maps, we put up signs.
You're talking, and I'd say for each location, you're probably at least talking to 20 to 25 people.
at least. You got to get permits with the city. Yeah. We do all that. So like scouting is probably the most fun part of it at the beginning, actually looking for places.
It's the most creative.
Yeah. And then after that, it's just like an endless amount of paperwork and dotting T's and crossing I's and making sure everyone's happy and paid off. And in the end, you know, our main goal is to make people happy enough that they want us back, you know, because, you know, if we ever need to come back in a future season of Better Call Saul or something like that, we want to make sure that we'll be welcome.
Yeah.
I've got some questions about some Better Call Saul locations, but I wanted to start off what I thought was the best story from the weekend on the Albuquerque Fan Fest, which is, you know, what you talk about, like, you know, being able to come back and film more locations. And you had a pretty, I thought, amusing and kind of heroic story about the chicken farm for Los Pollos Hermanos. Can you talk about the ultimate fate of that and how you guys worked around it and kind of, you know, the blood pressure raising aspects of it?
Yeah, the chicken farm story. So as a department, we inherited Breaking Bad in season 4. They had a different locations department that went on to a different show. And so we took over, basically. And we were taking over all the locations at that point, all the existed ones. And I think we kind of took the chicken farm for granted a little bit, that it was just there and nobody was using it.
Well, and nobody had talked about it either. Like, it wasn't even on the radar.
Well, it was. It was on the radar.
Not for a while.
Well, but anyway, basically, it came up in a script in season four. And I called them, and I, you know, just an initial call, say, hey, we're planning on coming back to shoot there if that's cool. You know, I'd like to come by and get some photos. And the woman says, oh, well, it's being set to be demolished tomorrow. And I go, okay. So I run to the producer, and I tell him what I was told, and he kind of freaked out for good reason.
Yeah.
Because Vince and them, as if you recall, in season four, there was a lot that happens in that chicken farm. There was like a shootout.
Sure.
You know, mm-hmm. Hank is like stalking it because mm-hmm. he's suspecting Gus
sure.
for things and things like that. So they had big plans for it. So. So the producer, he grabs a cameraman.
I love that.
And he goes out there and he goes, we're going out there to take establishing shots. And I was like, I don't have a contract. And he's like, get one. And so I go over there and I like throw him $200 and we go up on a hill and we just start taking establishing shots because the thing's set to be going down tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, so I'm calling their corporate office. I'm calling them. I'm saying, is there any way we can, you know, stop this? And they're like, no, basically the county has been hounding them to tear down those disgusting chicken farms for a long time because they haven't been used in years.
Yeah. Right.
And they were, you know, it was gross. Yeah. And it was probably, I don't know, making us all sick or something. So it took them a long time to get a contractor in the deal because that stuff is a process in itself. And once you get a contractor, you know, you have a contract. It's you're paying them thousands of dollars and there's no stopping them, basically.
Sure.
So what we had to do was we had to do a deal with the contractor himself. The guy who was, you know, hired to tear down these chicken farms, we had to make a deal with him. And he wasn't going to go, you know, he was going to tear him down by this certain day. He had a whole schedule. So we paid him a lot of money to basically start on one end and slow and tear down the chicken's farm from one end to the other,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we really just shot half of it, basically,
right.
when
yeah.
we put that trailer, you know, and basically he agreed to do that. And we got the scenes done. And the day after we finished the final scene of that sequence, it was dust. They tore it down.
That's cutting it close.
Yeah.
Yeah. It got lucky.
Not every day you have to deal with ticking time bomb scenarios with locations, I suppose. But
no, well,
not
even
every
like
day.
Jesse's house. They moved the garage on Jesse's house.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, this stuff happens, and it's life. And like, for instance,
property owners change hands too in the middle of seasons. We've had that happen. You have to deal with somebody else who might not necessarily want filming, but
yeah,
you try and talk with them about it. And
well, here's an example that might be an upcoming problem for us, which I was worried about this season, was Saul's office, his exterior, that shopping center that we used in Breaking Bad with Lady Liberty on top.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Around season five, it became a restaurant or a bar.
No, it's a bar now.
Yeah, it's a
There's
bar.
A couple bars in there.
So anyway, basically it was an empty space when they first started shooting there, and then mm-hmm. there's a tenant there now, you know, and it's not a lawyer office. Like,
yeah.
it would be a serious redress to make that happen.
Well,
so if you noticed in the
bar,
final right? seasons of Breaking Bad, we never saw the front of the store again. There was a couple of scenes where he's like on a payphone outside and you can see Lady Liberty in the background.
Right.
There's a scene where we were finding other alleys and things like that to pretend was the backside of his
yeah.
place, you know. So, you know, so if the Better Call Saul prequel gets to a point where we need that location, it's gonna
be tough. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but that's movie making.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these issues come up and you deal with them. So either we're going to have to find a new shopping center that looks like it, or it's going to have to be a complete build.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're going to have to pay that bar to let us redecorate it if that's what they want to
yeah,
do,
exactly.
you know?
Exactly.
I mean,
you never know.
There's always, you know, like if that chicken farm was gone, I mean, they could have written it out of the script, or we could have built the thing, you know, mm-hmm. depending on how, you know, Matt
sure.
matched it up. You know, it's just
I will say Vince tries to be pretty conscious of the other locations, though. They They try to plan things out.
Yeah, they are. And the thing about our job is when there is an issue like that, you can't panic. You just got to can't lie about it. You can't sugarcoat it.
Never show them your sweat.
Yeah, I can't go to the producer and be like, "Oh, you know, we're fucked. We're screwed. We have to go."
No, you can swear. You can definitely swear in this podcast.
Okay.
Okay.
You just got to go and say, "This is the situation. Yeah. This is what we can maybe do. I don't know what you want to do, you know, and we just have to talk about it." And a good producer will not flip out. They'll work out the issue, you know. That's what we do.
I don't want to switch gears here too much, but I'm really curious how you guys got started doing this. Were you like, "Oh, I'm the guy that everybody goes to find the cool hangouts in the area," or like, what is it about your like knowledge of the area or something that makes people come to you and say, "Hey, find us locations"?
Yeah, or to say another, were you involved in filmmaking and then because you knew the area so well, you got into scouting, or were you just the scouting and you got sucked into the film industry?
Well, for me, it was kind of along the lines of being a filmmaker and wanting to get into the film business. Like I did the film crew training course at one of the community colleges here at CNM. And it's basically a class that I went to after school where they kind of went through all the various below the line jobs. And I kind of got hooked up through them. I made some contacts and did some jobs that way. But because of my independent filmmaking, I also talked with the film commission a lot and kind of got to know her in making my individual stuff. And
the Albuquerque Film Office.
Yeah. And basically through both of those channels, I kind of had knowledge of the area and started going through the, you know, proper channels to get into the union and stuff, and kind of started out that way.
I have a completely different story. My situation was I always wanted to work in the movies in some aspect. And I was always wanting to go to L.A. when I was younger, you know, and try to do that, you know, any way I could. And around 2005, the movies came here because of tax incentives. A lot of things started filming here. And I was in a really bad part of my life, actually. I was working at my family's restaurant, and I was a college dropout, and I had nothing going for me. I was spinning my wheels, basically. And a movie was shooting in my family's restaurant.
Huh.
And my uncle basically got them to get me a job. And so basically I didn't even know what locations did. I was hired as a locations PA just to help kind of clean up and pick up trash and, you know, what we hire our PAs for, set up tents and heaters and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then I got hired for 5 days on a movie, and it turned into 5 months because it was an insane show.
That's what always happens. Somebody goes, "I got a couple days for you," and half a year later.
And from there, I kind of just kept working. Basically, locations is kind of a job that I'm not going to say not everyone can do it, but not everyone can do it. It's like
it sounds like you have to be detail oriented.
Yeah, there's kind of, and you do, and you have to be organized, and you have to, and you have to be a
problem solver,
and you have to be a public relations person. Yeah, you have to be friendly. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? There's just a bunch of aspects that, you know, some people just. I mean, so basically, if you're good at it, they keep you working type of thing. And for me, I started scouting maybe a little bit later on, like Breaking Bad, the pilot, which we also worked on. We did the pilot, then we came back in season 4. That was one of the first things I've ever scouted for. And I honestly didn't really know what I was doing. I was kind of just driving Vince Gilligan around and you kind of just learn from your mistakes and get better at it.
Sounds like podcasting.
Yeah. I mean, now we're kind of, it's been 9 years. We've kind of gained the reputation as like the Albuquerque, you know, as one of the more, you know, experienced Albuquerque scouts. And so, so sometimes, you know, we get calls a lot of times when movies are first coming in and things like that. But it's something you can work your way from the bottom like I did. It's something that, you know, if the movies are shooting in your town and you know the town and you can take good pictures and you can talk to people, yeah, I think it could be for you too. You know,
you mentioned in the second episode of Failed Scouts about tech scouting, and which is just real briefly, you taking all of the folks involved in making a episode or something, like the directors and the producers and the you know, lighting guys and all, and the camera guys and all that, in a big bus, and you go to all the locations, and essentially they bitch about it. And
is that what
and,
we said?
That's what we said.
Yeah, no, that's
it.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Essentially, well, they bring their concerns to you, and you address them with the property folks, and kind of make it happen, and you cater lunch. But it seems like that this is just big process, and you kind of talk about how you wish there was a different way. Like, you know, if this is like some big traditional Hollywood thing that maybe, you know, was started before we had cell phones and email addresses and stuff like that, but we still do it because we still do it. If you could change one thing about your guys' jobs to modernize it or better use technology, what do you think you would do to streamline it or make it better?
Well, the thing is, we're doing that all the time. Like, basically we're doing stuff that people have not done in the past. For instance, printing out a Google map and marking all the places where we're filming. You know, the technology that just wasn't there, you know, 6 years ago type of thing. You know, so we make these layouts. You know,
we're able to make good presentations of people and show them where our equipment's going to go, everything, from like an overhead perspective.
Whether or not anyone looks at the stuff when you hand it to them is another question.
Yeah.
And the tech scout, I mean, it is useful. I'm not going to say we need to reinvent the wheel here. It's just that it's kind of a big production a lot of times. You know, it's just a kind of a big unnecessary thing. You know, the producers bring their three assistants, you know, or whatever. You know, there's just a mat, you know, there's a mob of people that you're just trying. It's like herding cats. You know, mm-hmm. You're trying to follow a schedule. You're trying to get people in and out of a bus. You know, and then somebody has an issue and they make a, you know, and this is a, and they bring it up in a, let's say there's a certain department that has an issue with the location. We can fix that problem individually, but instead we're in a group of 60 people and we have to like work it out while everyone's, you know, chiming in and looking at each other. And, you know, it's just kind of gets
a lot convoluted. Of the times I think people kind of freak out too, is because all they've done at this point is they've just seen the script. So they know by what's written, how much work is kind of involved. And when you see like an itinerary come out, you're like, holy shit, there's 15 locations to go look at or 20 locations. It makes it even more. So they're kind of like going in with like a shock, not a shock phase, but just like, man, they kind of know what's coming up. And when they go there, they see it. And sometimes it's overwhelming for them to say, well, this is a lot to get done within 7 days. And
if you ask me what I would change is I would give
them
shows
more time
to put stuff together, especially in TV. I mean, they give us 7 days of prep and 7 days to shoot. Or something like that, and that comes from the studio, that comes from Sony or whatever, you know, because that's what they pay for, you know. But it's, if you want a big show like Breaking Bad with lots of locations, lots of things, you know, you have to.
Need the time. Sometimes to put together.
Yeah, so a tech scout is something where you drag people around. They get to see the place for 15 to minutes to a half hour. It's hard for them too. They have to look at it because they haven't seen it before. They got to look around, they got to decide what they need, they got to say what they need, and then get back on the bus and go to the next location, you know. If we had a few days to do this, if we had some time to like actually, you know, iron it out a little bit better, it would make it a whole lot smoother.
I think sometimes too, technology has kind of hindered the decision making process. It's made it a little more last minute because it's just that instant gratification. You sometimes have problems, you know, they just kind of put things off till the last, very last minute. And I'm not saying it's anything with Breaking Bad or Saul. It's pretty much every production
I've heard on Saul next season, they're going to give us an extra day of prep, which is going to help tremendously.
It will. You know, it really will.
Because Saul was kind of a chicken with your head cut off experience. For all the departments, we had a lot going on in every episode, and we were moving around constantly.
Is that usually the case with new shows? Does it get easier as the show progresses to get the locations because you have so many already established?
Yes, definitely. I think even at the end of Saul, things became kind of reoccurring.
Yes,
and so you.
there's more rhythm.
Yeah, and for us, we already have a contract that's been approved, so we can just re-sign it. You know, things like all that song and dance we already went through once. So, yeah, it does get a little bit easier. The stupid thing is, when you come back next season, you have to start all over from the scratch.
Exactly.
Because it's technically a different show that you're working for. Every season, you get laid off, and they close production, and then they start a new production, season two. And so every contract has to be new. Every insurance form has to be.
Yeah, and it's the same agreement that you've been signing for years. And
so when you're the woman at Walter White's house signs a new contract every year, every episode. You know, it's just a lot of, it's just lots of paperwork.
Wow, I had no idea that was something that that explains why things like the Chicken Ranch can happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and, you know, and with TV, like for Breaking Bad, you know, if we knew what we know now, we could have bought the White House, you know, or something, you know.
Sure.
All the times we went back, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say how much we paid them, but yeah, I'm going to say like over the time it added up. Sure. And but the thing is, Breaking Bad wasn't getting ratings the first few seasons, and every season they didn't know they were coming back. And so
like, what, end of
there
season three, it's really, or season three is when it really started to catch fire, I think.
Yeah, so basically if we knew we were going to have six seasons, we could have done a six-season contract or something, but that just doesn't exist in TV. You don't know if you're coming back, you don't know when, ever, and so you have to get new contracts every season.
Yeah, that was a surprise, because we, you know, we started covering Breaking Bad from season four on, kind of, you know, have a little bit in common there with you. But when we were going back through this winter and earlier in the summer, and we did seasons one and two as kind of like a rewatch retrospective. And I was looking at I guess I always assumed that Breaking Bad was at least a moderate hit, but it was struggling in like the million people watching it all the way up till season four when it just exploded.
Yeah.
And then it kind of doubled its audience in between seasons, every single season. But that was super surprising.
I think it was Netflix.
Yeah, I've heard Vince even say that Netflix may have saved the show because people binge watched it.
Yeah.
And that, because it was one of those shows, it was kind of had a Star Trek thing going on, like the original series. It was getting terrible ratings, but the fans who watched it were obsessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure.
So it was getting word of mouth. People have heard of it, you know, and even at Albuquerque, when I was scouting for season four, it seemed like nobody's seen it.
Yeah.
You know, it was like everyone's kind of, you know, everyone heard about it, you know, oh, you're that meth show, you know, and stuff like that. But then season five came around and everyone was like, oh, you're Breaking Bad. Come over here. You know, everyone was super, the whole attitude.
All wanting to get involved.
Yeah. Because I think the whole town saw it on Netflix or, you know.
Yeah, and I remember you guys talking about the early going, that that was even a stigma. It's like, you want to, do I want my house to be associated with this drug production?
Yeah.
Well, specifically in the pilot,
the schools were very hesitant, and
meth houses are a real problem in New Mexico. Yeah, and back then it was even worse, and it was a sensitive subject. And what happened is, we lost a location in the pilot because he read on IMDb that it was a show about meth, and he wanted nothing to do with it. And so after that, we weren't allowed to say meth. I remember I would go around and be like, oh, he's a teacher, and he gets sick, so he goes to a life of crime, you know, like not implying that he's a, you know, that he could rob banks or something.
It's funny sometimes how they try to, you know, tailor the story to help, you know.
Sure.
Not selling it to locations, but just the promotion of the show itself. Even though it may have some negative connotations, and it's all productions, they try to lighten it a little bit.
And it had a weird stigma in Albuquerque at first. Like, there was most articles about Breaking Bad the first few years is about how awful it is for Albuquerque and New Mexico, and it's making us look terrible. And then when
it really helped the tourism.
But when it became a hit, the whole everyone changed their minds. Right?
Yeah, sure.
Seems like.
Which is funny, because what I've found in covering the show and talking, because, you know, we get people that like are former meth addicts and email us and talk about like what it's meant to them, and seeing like, you know, Jesse struggle and all this stuff. What I've come to appreciate is every small town in America is essentially the meth capital of the United States. Like, everyone can make their own argument about their corner of the world being, because it's a pretty prevalent problem across the country.
And I agree.
Yeah, it certainly is.
So I want to talk about Better Call Saul for a bit, you know, since this is what the podcast is about. I remember it out because me and Jim were pretty nervous about covering, we're nervous about covering any show from day one, because, you know, the larger something has an audience, the more successful we are as a podcast. And we're like, man, on the one hand, this spinoff seems like a really good idea, but then on a lot of other hands, this spinoff seems like it could be, could go scary places, as far as like, it's just going to, you know, be more of a lone gunman than an X-File. And I asked a couple of the people, some of your collaborators and some of the people that were working on both, because this shares a lot of the same production staff. And I remember when I asked you, Alex, you said, you kind of paused and you said, well, the same people that made a lot of the same people that make Breaking Bad are working on this show, and we're bringing a lot of the same, you know, passion and positive energy. And I think you'll be happy with the results. And you did.
That was Alex, really?
Yeah. It's a rare moment of clarity he had.
Rare moment of positivity.
Yeah, and that's, it's funny because as fans, you know, we kind of watch the spinoff as kind of, you know, it's like, this is a piano recital. You're watching your kid. It's like, you know, oh, each scene's like, I don't want it to fail. But it's really hit its stride, and it's been a hit right out of the gate. I mean, were you guys behind the scenes kind of worried about whether this would deliver, or when you guys were looking at the scripts and seeing how things are coming together, you're like, yeah, this is going to work?
That's a tough question.
And the results are going to lay out. I mean, I'm curious to see what the world thinks about the rest of the season. At my personal view, when I read those first two scripts or outlines, I guess, I was so excited.
Yeah,
I felt like,
wow,
I had to be a part of it. I thought those first two episodes were awesome.
Yeah.
And then I think I kind of shared what you guys are sharing. This is, every episode kind of surprised me after that. And, you know, just kind of real curious on where it's all going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like this, and, you know, we kind of thought that this show is getting kind of its stride as a more, you know, broadly comedy type show. And then they hit us with the Mike episode, and it's like, wow, well, we're not ready for this jelly. I it's like, you know, it's still, it's like, what kind of show can this show be? What kind of show is this show going to be over time? And it's fun to see it kind of, you know, like you said, the fans get experience with it in the world and kind of accept it. But it seems like you guys have got a real hit on your hands, and you guys already got a season two. Like, that was,
yeah, they okayed that right out of the gates.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and the questions you're asking are the questions I personally heard the writers asking each other constantly.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of show is this? What are we trying to say? You know, that's something that they're very conscious of. That's something that they really, you know, we're experimenting with, and I think they still are. You know, I'm not even sure if they know exactly what the show is yet, you know, whether it's funny or whether it's dramatic or what, you know, they're just...
Maybe they do. I haven't talked to them.
Yeah, they're just trying to flesh out the characters, mm-hmm. especially Jimmy's character, you know, and Mike's specifically, you know, the best they can is what I see that they're doing.
I think that's why it also went into the decision-making factor, the things that they had to decide throughout, you know, Saul season one. That they wanted to take care and do this as best they could and make an informed decision.
Yeah, but it's a confusing. I mean, it's a challenge for them from the beginning. I mean, they wanted the show to happen, but they talked about it being a sitcom at first.
Yeah.
I know,
mm-hmm.
you know, when they brought it up and they kind of, but Vince is kind of, I mean, I don't know if superstitious is the right word, but he really wanted it to be kind of the same format as Breaking Bad. Whereas he feels better, I think, that it's an hour long drama in Albuquerque with the same people. You know, then I think he feels more confident that the show will find itself from there. You know, no matter what it is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. I have a question that I'm not sure is going to make it into the podcast, but I wanted to ask it because I was curious. So you mentioned earlier, like, a rare moment of positivity from Alex. in your podcast, I know that even you said you get a little complainy sometimes. And, of course, it's your job, right? Everybody complains about their job.
Bitching is entertaining. That's a large part of our appeal, for sure.
It is. But when you're doing it in a public fashion like this, where, you know, your boss could tune in and say, I don't like what these guys are saying about me or about anybody I'm involved with. Do you worry about that? Do you think like, oh, I wonder if people are going to get angry about what we're saying? That kind of stuff.
There's always that bit of concern for
and,
sure.
Yeah, you should hear what I cut out. No, we're trying to be very conscious about that. We are not set out to make anyone feel bad. We're not set out to call anyone out on being an idiot or anything like that. If we are talking about somebody who frustrated us, I think we're very careful not to mention them by name.
Well, and it's usually more about the stress, the situation at work versus it actually being directed towards someone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more situational.
And we've been doing this a while, so it's a lot easier to tell stories that happened 5 years ago.
Yes,
you know, than it is talk about current jobs.
Sure, you could have somebody be like, "Oh, I remember that happened with me last week." Or, they must be talking about me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you right now, the producer of Lone Survivor is a psycho. I'm never going to work with that guy again. If he hears this, I hope he does. But I would never say anything like that about the wonderful people of Better Call Saul.
Sure. our nickname for Vince Gilligan is, right?
That.
We call him the Villigan because he seems like a very nice guy, but he's got a lot of twisted and evil things about him from a storytelling and fan perspective. Do you guys I want to talk about some of the things that I've kind of been impressed with Better Call Saul, and I don't know, some of this is like location work or some of it just might be like a sound set or a sound stage or whatever, like the nail salon. You look at that in the daytime with all the ladies there getting their feet done, and it's kind of an unassuming set. But that show, that thing comes alive when they shoot it at night, and they got like the fish tank lighting, and then it's all very suddenly turns into like film noir. But then you can do weird things like having Saul give Kim a pedicure and put some moments of levity in there. Is that the same nail salon that we were introduced to in, I think it was season 3 of Breaking Bad? Did you guys get a new location? Is the interior the actual interior of that spot?
Okay, I was asked this before. I don't remember the nail salon in Breaking Bad.
No, it's a
cameo.
Location-wise, it's a totally different one, but I think it's an homage to it, I think. I'm not sure.
Well, what happened at the one in season 3? I don't remember.
It was like a money laundering montage. Yeah. You know, you could do a nail salon, or you can do a laser tag, or you can.
He just mentions it, right? They don't go to one.
They were there.
Yeah, yeah. He met. I think he was getting a pedicure and his nails done while Walter and Jesse came to meet him there. I think is what it was. Exactly. It was the deal.
Oh, where did we shoot that?
It was the one off of the freeway. It was near Great Clips and Wax over there off of Jefferson or Osuna.
Yeah, no, it's a different nail salon, but I do think that I know that when they were writing Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, they went back to all and they went back and looked up. I think they even talked about their podcast. I think they printed out every line that Saul said and Mike said. You know, so and I know they are very conscious about Easter eggs and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I would guess that yes, they wanted to do an homage, like Dennis said, to that when they wrote in this nail salon. But I honestly don't know the
I know physically,
but it is a different location for sure. That this is a new one we found for this season.
And then is the interior night stuff? Is that is that actually the location, or is that a soundstage?
It's yes, all location.
Everything's location except for his little office.
Yeah.
Oh right. Yeah.
You go to the back, and there's no room there. It's just a closet. But But the exterior and the interior shots are the real place, and it's pretty much how the place is. The fish tank was there.
The fish tank is there.
What we did is we painted a mural that they kept. It's still there, the mural on the back, but that's really all the set dressing we did. They
They moved some stuff around.
Yeah, but that place, they have like fake hands and things like that. That's all stuff that they have there. You know, it's a real
really great guy.
I'm not sure exactly what. Are they Vietnamese or they're real Vietnamese family that owns it, and it's all very authentic.
Do you guys is there an interesting story behind the compound that Saul went to meet with the guy who wants to secede from the union and have his own money? That seems
Ricky?
Like a pretty huh
Is that his guy's name is Ricky, I think?
I wasn't sure if it was Rick, but you know, he wanted
Big Ricky.
He found Rickistan or whatever it was, the sovereign state of Rickistan. Where is that place? Was there a story behind it? I just thought it was just a very interesting looking location.
That place is a real house. It's run by a very nice family in town, and they have a huge trophy room full of animal heads.
So that was actually inside. That was actually as you guys found it.
Sort of, yeah. So basically we showed them that house in the last season of Breaking Bad. That was a house we scouted for Gretchen and Elliot's house in the final episode, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Vince and them company were very impressed with, you know, and they remembered it and actually wrote a scene for that house in the story. Now the funny story is kind of, well, funny, haha, but so the funny story is that when we took the director to see that house, you know, it was basically written for that house. You know, Vince and them asked if it was still available. We called the people. It was, they were very excited. We took the director at the trophy room is in an office in the house, mm-hmm. and she felt like it was too small to shoot in for all those scenes, you know? And so we basically took the trophies out of that room and put them in the living room. And so we didn't shoot it as is specifically like the nail salon, but the property is like that. It's a big property with a gate and, there's more houses in the beyond that gate than is shown. We make it look vastly more empty than it was. Mm-hmm. I think there may even been a digital erase in the background to make it a little more expansive as well. Cause there's desert behind it, but behind that there's a highway. And I don't think you saw that in the shot at all.
It looked very compoundy.
Yeah, exactly. Which was the idea, you know, because he was trying to secede.
What do you guys?
But that was a fail, Scout, because they had us look for more options, even though they wrote a scene for that house. We showed them more things.
Seems like the most possible fail of a scout.
You know, I think you could find a more essential version of the thing that we wrote the scene for. Could you look?
Well,
for that?
It was those details that I talked about. It was like, well, actually, the room's a little too small, and there's actually other houses on the property, so maybe we could find something a little more secluded that works better. All right, you know. And then we showed him pictures, and Vince was like, what's wrong with the one we have? Nothing. We can make it work. All right, let's make it work. All right, throw all these away.
Nice.
Is there anything you're especially proud of on this season that we've seen so far up through the Mike episode, the 5-0? Is there anything you guys are especially proud of as a git?
I think there's a certain amount of pride that me and Dennis could have about the Philadelphia sequence.
Yeah.
In the Mike episode.
I like that Philadelphia sequence. It came
We shut down a block of Albuquerque, downtown Albuquerque, for a week to decorate it like in the summer, to decorate it like Philadelphia in the winter,
mm-hmm.
with fake snow. And we closed down several businesses.
All while, you're filming the rest of the other episodes and stuff.
Too. Yeah, it was a huge deal. We had contracts all over the place. It was a lot of legwork, and it was a lot to pull off. And we pulled it off. Everybody was satisfied. And then we went to go shoot it, and it rained.
And lightning storm.
And we only shot the alley sequence, and we didn't see any of the street. And so no one was really sure what was going to happen. We undecorated the whole thing. We put everything back to normal on the next Monday. And then they said, okay, we're shooting it again this Friday.
Yep.
So we redecorated the whole thing in about a day.
As soon as everything was down, the trucks came right back to put it back
up. Yeah, we paid up the whole block again. We did the whole thing over again. And we shot the rest of the sequence. And I think that episode... Dennis, I don't think you saw it yet, but I think that episode was the best looking episode mm-hmm. so far. I thought that sequence looked really good, especially because it's Albuquerque, you know, it's not Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. And it's very stylized, too. You know, it's got that noir feel to it.
Adam Bernstein's a really great director.
He is.
Yeah.
He
is. Yeah. I really appreciated that episode a lot.
Another location I could be proud of is probably Stacy's house because... that's a house that I used to live in. It's my uncle's house. Yeah, and that was a last minute deal because we hadn't, because if you recall in the episode before, we had a small exterior shot of that house.
Sure.
You know, and we had a different house picked out already, and it was already like signed up. And then at the, and then when the script came out for the next episode, Adam Bernstein realized how much work he had inside that house, you know, with Mike and Stacy talking. And he wanted something else if we could. And so I basically had, I don't know, I basically pulled that one out of my, wherever I found it. And I, and it worked out. So basically it's a house that, that I used to live in that I've made several movies in. So it's something that's really kind of personal that's in there. You know, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard you guys talking about that on your latest show.
I have to say, like, I think one thing that added to it a bit is the Mike's parking booth, where it is versus what it was. I think that that kind of helps aesthetically. I think what they're using now is pretty interesting looking, and versus it being just written as a parking garage.
Yeah, it was written as a parking garage.
And
Dennis showed him that booth with the bridge over it.
The bridge kind of gives him a little more depth, and
it allowed us. It gives the troll the essential troll quality.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a cute little analogy, and definitely, and that was based on the location. It was not written like that, mm-hmm. and also gave us an opportunity to do exterior shots.
It's
real clear if it's day or night there,
mm-hmm.
and it was at the Albuquerque Convention Center, who were extremely helpful and very, very happy to be a part of it. So it worked. It was one of those locations that worked out for everybody,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was the situation where they had something completely different in mind, and then Dennis showed him something that completely changed the whole mm-hmm. look of it. And yeah, so it's prideful.
Awesome.
Well, do you have any other questions?
No, I think I'm good. We should probably point them.
That's what I was going to say. I'm sure that there's a lot of listeners. They'll probably be hungry for more behind the scenes details. And you guys are dishing that up over at failscouts.com. If you go there, you can find Failscouts on iTunes and all the other major places too. But if you're looking to find the feed and the show notes and all that stuff, Failscouts, all one word, .com is where you can keep up with Dennis and Alex. I really appreciate you guys giving us the time to talk with the fans and kind of get a little behind the scenes flavor for the production. I really appreciate it.
Oh, we're very happy. It's our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us. And
yeah, thank you
for plugging our show. It's a lot more stories like these. This is kind of just the way we just kind of want to give our perspective of the world out. We wanted to make a scouting movie.
Yeah, this is kind of our way to.
I even wrote a pilot called Scouts, you know. But I think
kickstart
this podcast,
that shit. Kickstart that shit.
I think this podcast is a good way just to let our stories out into the world.
The other thing you guys do that I thought was amusing, and I wasn't expecting it going into the show, is you do like a scouting review, a movie review, and you rate it on a series of orange construction cones.
Yeah, traffic cones. Yeah.
Like out of five traffic cones, and then you guys organically came up with the three and one bent cone for the 3.5 cones.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, we like to express our opinions, but
cones are such a big deal of our part of our job too.
Yeah, but we figure nobody really cares if we like a movie or not, but we do have an interesting perspective on the locations aspect, and we watch something and we decide whether we guess how they shot it. And
well, anymore, sometimes I'm watching a show and I'm like, damn, that scene must have been a bitch to put together. And you just like start thinking about all the work you got to do to put that together.
And we look up the location manager and we give him a shout out because it's something that rarely happens. We're kind of the department that nobody thinks of, you know, sometimes.
That's what I was going to say. I like about your podcast is that, you know, directors and actors and writers get so much attention, and then the people who kind of organize the logistics of making these things happen don't get so much attention. So your podcast really helps to, you know, draw some attention to those jobs. What did you call it? Below the line?
Yeah, below the line.
Yeah, what exactly does that mean?
Well, there's sadly, a line, like above the line is pretty much all the producers, actors. Those are considered your above the line.
What sadly, is the line?
Sadly, it's kind of an industry term.
And,
basically, it's crew versus the people who you normally hear from.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you also don't normally hear from the grips or
the
electricians, the art department, things like, you know, the costumers, things like that. I mean, basically, and honestly, I mean, I don't know who came up with above the line or below the line.
It was someone above the line, I guarantee.
Exactly. But they definitely had to create some kind of separation.
But sadly, it's kind of a class thing because in movies...
It's militaristic hierarchy.
Well, and it's also money. Those people make four times what the rest of the crew makes. Mm-hmm. So you know, so if you have a goal to be above the line, you know, it's not easy to get above that line. You know what I mean? It's not easy to become a working actor or a working writer.
It's amazing how small the film community is. When I first started, I thought I was going to meet, you know, people from all over the place. And I mean, I have met people from all over the place, but it's amazing how small it actually is. You see a lot of the same people coming back and they all talk with each other. So it's a really tight knit community.
Yeah. And I didn't really want to call our podcast that because I consider myself above the line because I was an actor in one scene in Breaking Bad.
So. Oh, that's right. That's right. So. Yeah. Okay. We were the giant liars. We're not done. We just, when we thought we were out, you pulled us back in. Yeah, talk about
Dennis,
talk about
Dennis
your,
below,
talk about Dennis your screen credit.
My eyes just rolled.
No, I had the tremendous and wonderfully blessed opportunity to play the waiter in the final episode of Breaking Bad that brought Lydia the stevia in the Grove. Yeah, which was an amazing experience.
Awesome. I applaud you for being able to do that.
Thanks. Indeed. Yeah, and that's a kind of an interesting story. Basically, I mean, I won't go too much into it. Basically, I'm kind of new to acting.
We'll let Dennis edit this part of the podcast.
Okay. Thank you.
No, I'm kind of new to acting, and I was never able to audition for Breaking Bad because I was crew, you know, which they don't normally do because there's actually SAG rules against that. You're supposed to audition all the SAG actors before you look to your crew and start hiring your friends or whatever, you know. So basically, I would never got an audition really until I was in a commercial locally that Vince saw that he said he liked, and he just kind of said, "Oh, you're an actor," and I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Oh, I didn't know that. You should audition for the show." And I was like, okay. And so I like ran to Melissa Bernstein, the producer, and I was like, Vincent, I can audition. Can I audition? You know, and she goes, sure, you know. So, but then there was only two episodes left, and so I auditioned for like the bartender at the inside the New Hampshire bar and things like that. And I didn't think I was going to get anything. And then,
you didn't go out for like random Nazi thug that got blown away. You didn't.
Well, I would have been interested in any role, you know, but okay. Actually, there's more of the story now. Here's an inside scoop. So what happened was it was the second to last episode and I was reading for some parts. And then I got the script for the final episode and there was a role in there. Basically, if you recall, when Walt is at the gas station, when he gets back into town and he calls Gretchen and Elliot, or he calls to find out where Gretchen and Elliot live on a payphone.
Sure.
There was a scene where he would go in, where he went into that gas station and the clerk was a former student who recognizes him. And they had an interaction and Walt comes up to him and he knows he's been recognized. And he tells the kid, "You were one of my students." And he was like, "Yeah, you were a good teacher, you know." And he was like, "I'm better at this." And he like, and he throws the kid some money not to call the cops, and he leaves. And the kid like pisses himself or something. Uh-huh. Anyway, so I was like, "Oh my god!" So I was like, "Can I read for that role?" You know, because that would have been like a role of a lifetime.
Sure.
You know? Uh-huh. And they said yes, and so I was studying for it. And everything, and I was getting ready to audition, and then it got cut from the show. Mm-hmm. And so then I thought, well, I guess that's it. You know, I am not going to be able to be in because that waiter role is actually scripted as a waitress. Mm. You know, and then they let me read for that, but I didn't think, you know.
Meanwhile, there's a bunch of work to be done.
As if you were even there.
It's like, Dennis, go find this location. I got some lines to prep.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this was on top of my workload for your information. But yeah, but then they gave me that leader role. I couldn't believe it. It was like the last role in the last season of the last. It was just incredible, and it was one of the most amazing days of my life. Because I got to be in a scene with Brian, mm-hmm. who was very. I was extremely nervous, and he was very, very helpful, and very nice.
They were an amazing cast to work with, honestly, from our perspective, I think. They were very friendly with homeowners and the public, and they actually kind of seemed to grab on to
I think that humbleness came from Brian down, because he was always such a humble guy, and all the other actors kind of followed suit. It was a really pleasant show to work on, for sure.
That's always nice to hear. I had one other question that came about, but then I just got into your story and I completely... Oh, yeah, I know. I just want to ask something for both of you guys. You mentioned, like, on some shows, you kind of like it's like, oh yeah, Game of Thrones has some pretty good. That's got some five cone locations.
Yeah.
is there a show, like, do you guys both have like any like dream gigs, like any current show or recently released movie that you're like, oh man, if I could get in on that,
I would love to get on Game of Thrones. That'd be awesome.
Is that everybody's like dream gig right now?
Well, I mean, it'd be fun to, I think, to work in another country mm-hmm. other than the U.S. I mean,
until you're stuck on a glacier in Iceland for 2-3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I know the grass is always greener, but it'd still be such an experience, you know, that I'd love that opportunity. I think why Game of Thrones is just because they have something established that I think would be fun to be a part of, and either that or Vikings. I would do Vikings too. Mm.
Dennis likes the fantasy stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you do get the cool locations. You know, it's not like all steel and concrete.
Yeah.
In fact, you try to avoid those and those type of.
Yeah.
My dream job is the night shift for NBC.
He's living it now.
Living the dream.
Because we mostly shoot it on our hospital stage, so it's a
locations. It's like the dream job. Yeah, you have one day out a week. It's the exact opposite of Saul.
It's the show I'm currently on now.
Right. Nice. Well, again, if you have enjoyed this segment, I highly encourage you to seek out Alex and Dennis over at failscouts.com. Again, guys, thanks for joining our podcast. Really looking forward to the rest of Better Call Saul.
All right, our pleasure. I hope you enjoy it.